Okay, and a couple little housekeeping matters. You will see Justice Pickering sitting there all by her lonesome in Las Vegas. Hi, Justice Pickering.
Hello.
Okay, we can...
Can you hear me?
Yes. First matter we have on calendar today is docket number 62869, Middleton versus Warden. Are you ready to proceed?
Yes, John.
Okay, come on up.
May it please the court, counsel. My name is David Anthony. I represent the petitioner, David Middleton, in this case.
Mr. Anthony, before you start, I have a question for you. Notice there's about 28 issues here. At least I counted 28 issues, probably even more. You've raised 28 issues here. I'm curious as to why you didn't ask for a 60-minute hearing, 30 and 30, rather than 15 and 15 for the 28 issues.
Well, I've never been asked anything like that before. Usually,
I figured that.
Usually I take what I'm given. But in the future, if I have that opportunity, I'd certainly be interested in taking more time. I think the court makes a good point about the number of issues. There's also a motion for limited remand involved in the case as well. So I think that definitely could be helpful for the court.
Before you start into actual arguing the case, could you tell me what issues are the most important, spare my colleagues from having to decide of the 28 or more issues, which ones we should really be looking at?
Well, obviously one of the primary issues involved in the case is the issue of ineffective assistance of first state post-conviction counsel, since that's the procedural gateway that we use to get to the underlying claims that we argue that should have been raised if first post-conviction counsel would have performed effectively. There were a couple of issues that I definitely plan to highlight at the argument here today. Primarily the issue about the presentation of false testimony regarding the ownership of the pink plaid blanket that was testified at trial as belonging to one of the victims, Thelma Davila. The other issue that I wanted to cover as well were the issues of ineffective assistance of direct appeal counsel for not adequately pleading issues of prosecutorial misconduct that occurred when Mr. Middleton was questioned by law enforcement and by the district attorney without being read his Miranda rights and without honoring his invocation of his right to counsel. So those are two that I can think of just off the top that...
Well, you got 13 minutes left, so have at it.
Also, I'd like to reserve 4 minutes for rebuttal, if I might.
Yes.
The order that this court is reviewing today was authored in pertinent part by an attorney that's been disqualified by this court from representing the state. The attorney was disqualified because he met with Mr. Middleton in the jail in January of 1996 and received privileged information from him about the case, about his criminal history, about other investigations in other jurisdictions, and about mental health evidence that had been generated and was work product based on evaluations of Mr. Middleton. At the present time, the court has not decided whether or not this order that's being reviewed actually can be reviewed in a reliable manner. The other issue that arises from the representation by the prior attorney for the state is there are constitutional violations that have resulted. There's issues of due process and issues of the right to counsel that are implicated in this habeas proceeding that I believe need to be resolved. In a motion for limited remand that I filed, I've requested that the court remand the case for the reinitiation of habeas proceedings in Department 9 because given the prior disqualified attorney's role in the creation of the order, I don't think it's appropriate for this court to review the order now. I think that the case should be sent back first. Mr. Middleton argued that imputed disqualification was also required for the district attorney's office. In the evidentiary hearing that this court ordered, It was discovered on cross-examination that the attorney disclosed to his supervisor, who was representing counsel for the state for Mr. Middleton, that he'd had this privileged conversation with Mr. Middleton. And instead of taking him off or creating a timely ethical screen, the attorney was put on the case. So I think that there are some serious issues here about whether there's been an institutional breakdown in the district attorney's office that warrants imputed disqualification in this case. It was even worse because when we went down for the evidentiary hearing, the district attorney's office exploited it by arguing that they would call Mr. Middleton and try to force him to testify about other investigations that they're currently pursuing. They're currently pursuing investigations in missing persons cases in Reno from 1994. So that's another big problem. And then the final problem here is that there hasn't been any proof that there's been the creation of an effective ethical screen in this case. The court, when it disqualified counsel, said that an ethical screen had to be created. But as of today, there's no proof that an ethical screen has been created. And to be honest, I don't really know how an ethical screen could be effectively created in this case when it wasn't done in a timely manner. The disqualified attorney was representing the state for almost a year. This court's precedents in Ryan Express say that this court will order an evidentiary hearing where the burden of proof is on the party seeking to avoid imputed disqualification to show that an ethical screen has been created. But as of the present time, nothing has been required of the state. In Ryan Express, counsel tried to submit affidavits saying that an ethical screen had been created, but in that case, they said it wasn't sufficient. But here, nothing has been done, and there hasn't been any evidentiary hearing. So right off the top, what I would request is that we remand the case for reinitiating the habeas proceedings to determine whether there's been an effective ethical screen. And if there hasn't been, then I think we need to have a special prosecutor representing the state in this case. So just right off the top, I think that's very important. Because the court needs to know that the order that it's reviewing can actually be reviewed and it has reliability to it. As I mentioned a moment ago, in Mr. Middleton's petition, he has alleged that the state presented false testimony at trial and that his trial counsel was ineffective for failing to put forward evidence that was provided by the prosecutor in discovery that would have shown that Mr. Middleton was actually the owner of the pink plaid blanket that was used by the state at trial to tie him to Thelma Davila. At the time of trial, the prosecutor presented three witnesses and argued in closing that the pink plaid blanket was evidence that connected Mr. Middleton to Ms. Davila because she was the owner of the blanket. The evidence currently before this court shows pretty clearly and definitively that Mr. Middleton was actually the owner of the pink plaid blanket. And the photographs that are attached as exhibits in the appendix show that he had the blanket when he was living with his wife back in Florida. So it's pretty clear that he was actually the owner of the blanket, not Ms. Davila. The state also argued to this court on direct appeal, and this court made findings in its factual recitation, and also when it reviewed the sufficiency of the evidence, that there was sufficient evidence because of the issue about the ownership of the blanket. In this petition, we've argued that first state post-conviction counsel was ineffective because they didn't raise these issues of ineffective assistance of trial counsel and presentation of false testimony, given the fact that they actually had possession of the videotape, that if they would have reviewed it, it would have shown that Mr. Middleton was the owner of the blanket. We've also asserted that the state failed to disclose material, exculpatory, and impeachment information pertaining to Dora Valverde. She was the sister of Thelma Davila, who testified as to her sister's ownership of the physical evidence that was admitted at trial. We've alleged that the state failed to disclose evidence that Ms. Valverde suffered from intellectual disability, and that there was information in the prosecution file that would have shown that she was having substantial difficulties getting a handle on basic facts, like when her sister was missing, what the circumstances were. And those questions were fielded by a person who ended up being the interpreter at trial for Ms. Valverde. It was Ms. Sattler. And so we've alleged that the state violated its obligations under Brady and under Kyles by not providing that information to trial counsel. Because in a case like this, where the primary evidence connecting Mr. Middleton to Ms. Davila is the physical evidence in his storage shed, it would be very important for the jury to know that Ms. Valverde had these issues and had these problems that would implicate her ability to reliably identify physical evidence that she said was her sister's. And the proof of the materiality is in the fact that the jury was deliberating in this case for 4 days and informed the court that they were hung on the Davila counts. So that shows that any slight bit of evidence about the ownership of the blanket, about the ownership of the physical evidence that was seized from Mr. Middleton's storage shed, our position is that that evidence is material, and that if it had been disclosed by the state, that there is a reasonable probability of a more favorable outcome at the trial.
You're at 4:30. Do you want to reserve?
I'll reserve my remaining time. Okay. Thank you, Your Honor.
Thank you.
Good morning, Mr. Chief Justice, Justices of the Court, Justice Pickering. I feel like I should acknowledge you. I'm Terry McCarthy, WDA from Washoe County, on behalf of the state. I'm not quite sure I understand the position here that this court has ruled about the involvement of Joe Plater, the involvement of the Washoe County District Attorney, that there's been a ruling. I suppose we can call that res judicata. It was a motion, the court ruled on it. The suggestion that it has been proved that Mr. Plater, in fact, got confidential information is unproven. Mr. Plater testified that he recalled that there was a meeting and general topics, and that was it. And Mr. Middleton didn't testify at all. And there's this court's ruling was only that there was an appearance. So in order to lend confidence to the system, we should disqualify Mr. Plater, but not the Washoe County DA. So now the suggestion seems to be not only should this court overrule that order, but then you should overrule it retroactively and have a do-over. It is also based on the proposition that Joe Plater authored the decision, which is the subject of this appeal. And while he certainly prepared a draft, if I'm asked, is it true that the judge signed it verbatim without any changes? I couldn't say that. I don't have any way of knowing that. But I would point out that the petitioner also complains that it was based solely, taken solely from the motion to dismiss that was prepared by my predecessor, my old boss, Gary Hallstatt. Well, you can't have it both ways. It was either that Joe Plater did it or that the judge just relied solely on Gary Hallstatt. But you can't have it both ways. Anyway, I suggest that it's unsettled. We've already asked for a ruling, and this court has issued a ruling. Said that Joe Plater was disqualified, Washoe County DA was not. And it was only prospectively, and only because of the appearance, the need to maintain confidence. And so I suggest that any further relief would be inappropriate and uncalled for. We already did that once in this case when the somewhat infamous ruling involving Bruce Lindsay, because of the appeal from the first denial of habeas, this court, in an effort to I don't know if chastise, to respond to Mr. Lindsay, punish the citizens of the state by saying, no, 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 not only is your brief stricken, this is a do-over. We're going to vacate the judgment in the trial court and allow this case to be tried or plead it over again. We already did that once. I don't think that there's any call to do it again. The basic claim that is the subject of the ruling that gives rise to this appeal isn't what you just heard. It's not whether trial counsel is ineffective. That's been done. That's been done here. Now, the ruling giving rise to this appeal is that the claim in the most recent petition is barred by Laches. And it is. It was more than 5 years after the conviction. 34.800 has no exception. It has no exception for people that have tried very hard. It has no exception for people that claim that they have ineffective appellate counsel and post-conviction counsel. That is the authority of the legislature. The legislature could say, well, if you've tried very hard, then there's no Laches bar, but they haven't. This is not the great writ. This is not the constitutional habeas corpus. In fact, the post-conviction habeas corpus petition is about as far removed from the great writ as one can get. The common law writ of habeas corpus, the offense was a judgment from a court of jurisdiction. Now that's not a defense, it's a prerequisite. So we're not suspending anything. This creature of the legislature, entirely a creature of the legislature. The states are not required to provide any sort of collateral review. We do, but our legislature has put limits on it. One of them is move it along and get it done within 5 years. So the arguments I hear today, that we've seen, about that would make it impossible. Those are the same arguments as this court heard before in Pellegrini, with the same lawyers, by the way. In Pellegrini, the question was, should the one-year time limit apply to a second petition? And the argument was, well, no, because that would make it impossible. And the ruling was, well, yes, it does, doesn't it? But that is the authority of the legislature. I would urge a court to find that to be true in this case. The legislature in 34.800 has provided that there is a rebuttable presumption of prejudice to the state if the petition is filed more than 5 years after the conviction. Middleton has made zero effort to rebut that presumption. Instead, he has simply argued this court should construe the statute to include language that isn't there, to create an exception that the legislature has not put in that statute. Well, I suggest that this debate ought to be had in the halls of the legislature, not the halls of this court. Now, I do have to concede one little bit here. There was a part of my brief that suggested that the petition was not filed as quickly as it might have after the last go-around. And this court's recent decision in RIPO seems to undercut that, as the court established a clearer line of 1 year from last go around. So
you're conceding the good cause aspect?
Oh, no. No, not a bit of it. No, in fact, that is an entirely separate issue. What I'm suggesting is that it is a timely claim of the excuse to overcome the procedural bar.
Your position on the procedural bars, if you would.
Absolutely. There are primarily one is Laches. The secondary one, that's not even a word, is it? Okay. The secondary bar is it is more than a year after conviction. That can be overcome sometimes. And in this case, the claim that is to be used to overcome it is a claim that post-conviction lawyers were ineffective That has a couple of problems. One of them is there is no factual allegations that post-conviction counsel were ineffective in some specific way. Instead, what you have is the repeated assertions that failed to develop something. But in Evans versus State, this court told us how to plead a claim of ineffective assistance of someone other than trial counsel. And it gets specific. Now, if there was a claim, for instance, that the post-conviction lawyers were Tom Qualls and Natalie Quinn, if there was a claim in the petition that those guys didn't know what was allowed, those guys didn't know that you could make a claim of ineffective assistance of trial counsel, okay, that would be a valid claim. Now, a valid pleaded excuse to overcome the procedural bars. And we could have a hearing and find out, is it true that those two lawyers were just so ignorant that they didn't know how to go about their business? But that's not there. Instead, virtually all the petition, like the briefs in this court, skip that step and go right to trial counsel was ineffective. Well, we've done that. We've done it twice now. The Qualls and Wayne raised 71 claims of ineffective assistance of counsel. And before them, you know, the first go-around, I don't even know how many there were. Lots. There were many, many claims.
Let me get this straight.
Yes.
So the ineffective assistance of trial counsel, you say it's done. It's a done deal already. It's been ruled upon all the issues. And then we have ineffective assistance of appellate counsel. And then we have ineffective assistance of post-conviction relief counsel.
Right.
So we've got these three ineffective assistance at various layers.
Right.
Saying some of it's barred, some of it isn't barred.
Well, no. The alleged ineffective assistance of post-conviction counsel isn't a claim. It didn't lead to the conviction. So it happened after the conviction. So that pesky linear nature of time precludes the conclusion that post-conviction counsel led to the conviction. Instead, the alleged post-conviction counsel, the alleged ineffective assistance of post-conviction counsel, is offered as an excuse to overcome the various procedural bars. It's untimely, it's excessive, it's abusive, and it's barred by latches. By the way, the alleged ineffective assistance of post-conviction counsel won't overcome the latches part. It would only overcome the others if it were proved.
Mr. McCarthy, counsel for Mr. Middleton commented on the pink blanket issue.
Yes.
Would you respond to that also as to the mental IQ, so to speak, or of one of the witnesses reference that? And I guess the fundamental issue is he's asserting indirectly or directly that there's prejudice, if you'd comment.
Well, I suppose that would be, if it has any relevance at all, it would be in the analysis of prejudice. The trial testimony from the witness he's mentioned, she initially said, that's my sister's blanket. And then when questioned on it, she said, well, you know, it looks like it. And so she said, it's the same style, same color. But no, I can't say this is the very same blanket. Although Middleton apparently would have this court's rule that he can look at it and say that is the very same blanket, but not the other witness. So the arguments following that were that this is a reasonable inference, in particular that that hairs with the DNA from the victim are found with the blanket and on the tape and such, and so. You know, it looks like a blanket owned by the victim. It allows a reasonable inference that of what happened here. There wasn't more than that. There's nothing to disclose on the. I wonder if Brady applies to the internal thoughts of some prosecutor. If I have to reveal my subjective evaluation of someone's ability to recall, I suggest it does not. I also suggest that it's not impeachment material. If it is, what does it impeach? If we can't identify this sentence and say if only we had known that some prosecutor thought she was of limited intelligence, then that would call on the jury to reject her testimony. And by the way, if we're going to do that, shouldn't the prosecutor be allowed to give his own opinion of the subject? I don't know what the impeachment evidence is supposed to be or what it was supposed to have impeached.
Before you move on to the other part of Justice Douglas's question, I'd just like to stick with this one.
Yes.
What allegations were made in this petition that post-conviction counsel were ineffective in raising this claim?
If there was any at all, and frankly, I don't have the petition in front of me to flip through it. If there was any at all, it would have been simply the repetitious claim that failed to develop. Counsel failed to adequately develop. Although my recollection is that it was presented in the post-conviction action, although in a slightly different guise. And the court will recall in the various cases on the law of the case that the attempt to refine the issue doesn't get you beyond the law of the case. And I suggest that should apply here as well. The issue of the pink blanket and who actually owned it and who knew what, that was indeed explored. And I think that if there is any mention of trial counsel's ineffectiveness at all in the current petition, it is simply post-conviction counsel's ineffectiveness. It is simply that it wasn't adequately developed. Which also leads me to conclude that a phrase like that, adequately developed, would require necessarily a subjective evaluation of the performance of counsel. And that's not the way we're supposed to do it. We're supposed to have an objective evaluation. Was I interrupting you, Justice? No, okay.
I was going to ask, I think, if you'd cover the other area that Justice Douglas asked about.
I think you inquired about the pink blanket and
just in general, they're asserting prejudice. They need that prejudice prong to overcome.
Well, it was in the context of Ms. Valverde's testimony.
Right, and it's raised as trial counsel's ineffectiveness, I think, and or somebody's, because of a Brady claim, and there isn't one. Because that's not impeachment evidence, and the subjective opinions of the prosecutor needn't be disclosed anyway. And the fact that somebody wanted to meet with her, somebody wanted to have a conference with her, establishes a zero, nothing. And this may be, I've gone past my time. I don't know how that happened.
Colleagues, do you have any other questions? All right, Mr. McCarthy, thank you.
Thank you.
Mr. Anthony, you've got 4 minutes and 24 seconds remaining.
Thank you, Your Honor. I'd like to respond some more to the issue of the disqualification, but counsel for the state, I think, brings up a critical issue that I think needs to be addressed, and that's the issue of laches. What he's suggesting is that, I mean, this court has had Crump v. Warden on the books now for 20 years, and what he's suggesting is that even though we have a timely claim of ineffective assistance of post-conviction counsel, that this court is powerless to hear it because of the laches bar. I don't think that that's the case. I think that the laches bar should be construed consistently with the other default rules, which means that the time period during which an ineffective attorney is representing a petitioner cannot be counted against them. This case is a perfect example. Mr. Middleton was originally represented for over a year by conflicted counsel who were his trial attorneys before they were removed. Then they put on Bruce Lindsay. Bruce Lindsay came up on appeal, and the court told him to change his brief, and he ripped off the last 8 pages and refiled it, which caused the court to remove him. By the time that these post-conviction attorneys were appointed, the 5-year time bar had already run. So what's Mr. Middleton supposed to do? Why is the delay imputed to him when the issue is that he has either conflicted, no counsel, or ineffective counsel? This court has indirectly addressed that issue in Ripo, where the court held just a couple months ago that a claim of ineffective assistance of counsel is not reasonably available until the conclusion of the state post-conviction proceeding. Well, Mr. McCarthy correctly has acknowledged that this was a timely assertion by Mr. Middleton to vindicate his right to the effective assistance of post-conviction counsel, but what he's also saying is, sorry, you were out of luck 7 years previously. That can't be the way that the Lathis bar is applied, particularly in light of the Rippo decision. All of the reasons in Rippo explain why Lathis can't be applied here too. It provides a bright line rule, so the issue doesn't depend on the vagaries of how long counsel took or how long it took to actually get an attorney appointed. I mean, in Clark County right now, they have people who are waiting for the appointment of counsel, and it's been over a year or so. So it's very difficult finding these capital attorneys. So the idea that we're going to hold this against someone subjectively based upon circumstances beyond their control just can't be the law. That can't be the way it is. All of the reasons brought up in Rippo, you need time to investigate post-conviction counsel's ineffectiveness. You need clear boundaries. You need fairness and predictability. Where is any of that if you adopted the interpretation that the state's giving? I don't think that this court would have had Crump in existence for 20 years and applying it if it was all for naught, because there was a procedural default rule somewhere that precluded the whole inquiry. That can't be what the law is. And there's more authority on this, too. In this court's Powell decision from 2006, the state asserted latches based on a 15-year delay from the end of the penalty hearing to the time that first state post-conviction counsel filed their supplement. This court rejected that argument, saying that the delay was not attributable to Mr. Powell. It was due to the fact that the Supreme Court of the United States reversed this court's decision on direct appeal. And it was due to the fact that this court had an appeal in 2002 that was reversed in part for an evidentiary hearing. So it wasn't Mr. Powell's fault. Well, the same result needs to follow here. It wasn't Mr. Middleton's fault that he was appointed conflicted counsel at the first state post-conviction. It wasn't his fault that he had an attorney whose performance was so poor that he was sua sponte removed by this court. This court's effort in putting the case back and reinitiating the habeas proceeding was a laudable effort to protect his rights. And now we're going to say that he can't vindicate his rights under Crump because he's out of time, and he was out of time before counsel were even appointed to represent him?
Mr. Anthony, may I interrupt you yes. on the time issue and shift gears to a separate question? Taking as an example the pink blanket argument you had made earlier, what specific allegations are made in the petition as to the ineffective assistance of post-conviction counsel in raising that claim?
I believe what's alleged in the petition is that counsel was ineffective for not raising the issues of ineffective assistance of trial and direct appeal counsel that are contained throughout the petition. And I believe that's just up to my memory about how it was pleaded in the petition. I wasn't actually on the case back then, but that is my recollection of how it was pleaded.
But was not the pink blanket contentions asserted in the original post-conviction proceeding?
What was asserted, Your Honor, was a claim of prosecutorial misconduct in argument, because the argument was is that the prosecutor mischaracterized the testimony of a defense witness who testified that Mr. Middleton was the owner of the blanket. And so the issue raised by state post-conviction counsel was one of prosecutorial misconduct in argument. It's our contention that once post-conviction counsel chooses to raise a claim, they need to develop it fully. And that's why we argue that they were ineffective, because if they raised the sliver of a claim, they didn't have a strategic reason for not actually reviewing the videotape evidence to show that, in fact, Middleton was the owner of the blanket.
And that's wasn't there other testimony that by other witnesses that there was a blanket that appeared to be similar to the one that belonged to Ms. Davila, and they couldn't be certain. And so there was no testimony, as was indicated, that yes, this blanket belonged to her. It was fairly ambiguous testimony as to whether it belonged to her or not.
Well, my response.
So what's the prejudice?
My response to that would be that Mr. McCarthy is only referring to one witness, Ms. Valverde. There was also Susan Gamboa. And if you look at the redirect examination by the prosecutor, it's very strong that Ms. Davila was the owner of the blanket. There was also the testimony of Mr. Phillips that it looked like the blanket as well. And it was a centerpiece of the prosecutor.
On cross-examination, I thought she basically conceded she couldn't positively say that the blanket was the same one that was in the Davila home.
That, I mean, if we're talking about witness Valverde, there was that
cross. The other witness, Susan Gamboa.
And then if you look at the redirect examination by Mr. Valoria, I believe that he goes back on that point pretty strongly. And, I mean, it was strong enough evidence that the court made it as part of its factual findings on direct appeal. So it was obviously strong enough that the court believed that it was well shown by the evidence. And I think that's why we would argue that it's material.
Okay.
And why there should be a hearing.
Thank you.
Thank you.
And colleagues.
I want to make sure that I understand this. It sounds like maybe we'll be talking about ineffective assistance of post-conviction relief counsel in our disposition. Are there viable issues as to ineffective assistance of trial counsel and ineffective assistance of appellate counsel that should be handled in this post-conviction relief?
Yes. The first one is the ineffective assistance of trial counsel claim, because the prosecutor provided the videotapes in discovery, but trial counsel, we would argue, didn't adequately review them, because if he had, he would have been able to show the video evidence that we have that the blankets are owned by Middleton. So that's an allegation of ineffective assistance of trial counsel.
So whether it's an affirmance or a reversal, it has to be three layers: ineffective assistance of trial counsel, ineffective assistance of appellate counsel, and ineffective assistance of post-relief counsel, if in fact none of these are time-barred.
I would argue that it's only two layers and not three, because the role of appellate counsel is so much different than trial counsel. Usually the IEC of trial counsel issues are based upon evidence that's outside of the record, whereas we all know that direct appeal counsel is confined to the record. And so I would argue that there's only two levels that need to be traversed: ineffective assistance of state post-conviction counsel to ineffective assistance of trial counsel, and then the level from ineffective assistance of state post-conviction counsel to ineffective assistance of direct appeal counsel. So I would argue two layers, based upon whether the evidence was in the record and preserved for objection, or based upon the fact of whether it required investigation outside the record. So it'd be two levels, I would argue.
I'm finished. Okay, anything else?
Yes, one question. Do you have any evidence that Mr. Player prepared the order that we are reviewing in this case?
Yes, I do. I submitted it in the supplemental appendix. I included the motion for reconsideration that he filed, and then I included the enclosure that he gave to the trial court, Judge Elliott, where he attached his cover letter. And so it actually shows that he was the author of the motion for reconsideration, he was the author of the proposed findings of fact and conclusions of law, and then the court can see the final order signed by Judge Elliott. So that's all in the supplemental appendix.
Anything else, Justice Pickering? Any questions?
No, thank you, Chief.
All right. Mr. Anthony, thank you, and in fact, both counsel, we appreciate you being here. We appreciate the briefing in this matter, and the matter will stand submitted.